Hey everybody, I'm Kyle. I'm an alcoholic. And I am thankful to be here and thankful to be sober today. And I always get moved when I get to tell my story because it reminds me of where I came from. And I was sitting there, as I was sitting there praying a moment ago, I was thinking about the day that I hit my bottom, you know, the time when I felt like a turtle on my back and I was looking up and I had nowhere to go, and I would have never thought that anything I had to say would help anybody at that time. And today, through the miracle of this program, it's a totally different story. The first thing I want to do is thank Sam for calling me and you for having me, and my higher power for bringing me right here, right now, to this precise moment so that I could be who I am today, though I've had a background that wasn't maybe so pleasant at times. My life today is transformed. I have a beautiful wife who loves me and 28 years of marriage, and she smiles when I say that. And I actually have friends today that love me, and I truly love them, and they travel here with me just because they care. And I have a relationship with my daughter and my grandchildren today. And it's all because of this program. I mean, it started the day that I walked into AA and I said, I need help. My name's Kyle, I'm an alcoholic. And I was so afraid. So I'm very, very blessed today, and I've been showered with God's mercy. But it hasn't always been that way. And I want to share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today for me. That was a little bit of what it's like today. But when I was 5 years old, and this is an important part I've learned in my story, my father left. And I remember the day that he left, I had he gave me a toy truck. And he gave me this toy. I had no idea what was going on. My mom was there, and he was there. And then I never seen him again. And he never came back. And, you know, I realized today how much that affected me through growing up. I never thought it did, but it really affected me a lot with, like, rejection, for an example, like getting a sponsor. You know, what if I'm rejected? I'll get into that a little bit and how blessed I was for the group that I went to. But so I grew up. My mother was a drug addict and alcoholic, and I got taken away from her, and I lived with my grandparents. They were good people, you know. My grandpa drank and cussed a little bit, like dagnabbit, you know, that kind of thing. And my grandma went to church, and they loved me. And they had food, and the house was clean. And I stood up in the front seat of the car, you know, the full seat cars back then. And I'd stand in the middle and hold the dash, and grandpa would drive, and grandma would hold me. And so I had a good childhood growing up. As far as that goes, but I had this emptiness because my father left and my mother, I got taken away from her, and she cared more about other things than she did me. And that affected me also. So I grew up, I'm from upstate New York, Buffalo area, and we moved to a place called Hall, New York, and I went to junior high school there, elementary school, junior high school, and I met my lovely bride there, Chris, and she asked me if I had a light. You know, we were good kids, you know, smoking in the bathrooms. And so I said, sure I do. And when she turned around to walk away, I was like, I got to get to know her better. And so she passed me a note in class one day. And the note said, do you party? And I said, yes. I do anything for you. So I hadn't really partied to that point. I mean, I didn't know what that was, but I was going to start figuring it out, and my friends were all at the same age, and it was experimentation time, and I remember the circle of people, and I remember I seen it coming around, and I remember going, oh, man, I know I'm not supposed to do this. Oh, man, I'm afraid, but I did. I partook in this. And it made me feel funny, and it was fun, so I continued to do it. And I started to date Chris, and she became my girlfriend full-time. I officially had a girlfriend. And because of that emptiness that was in my life, she had the same emptiness in her life with a mother and father. And we were looking for each other. And we were only 14 years old, but we were looking for each other. And we were in love. And we knew we were in love. And so her mother got upset and said I was bad for her and threw her out of her house. And she ended up moving in with us. My mother and my stepfather took her in. And she lived with us. And we were allowed to sleep in the same room. And it's just the way it was. So we got pregnant. 15 years old, and my son Joey was born. He was born in 1983. We got married. He was born February 25th, 1983. We got married in 1984, April 7th. And my lovely daughter Marie was born September 2nd, 1985. New York was tough. You know, I started partying with my friends more. I'm leaving her at home pregnant. You know, that's your job. You take care of the kid. I'm going to party. I'm living life, having fun. And she started to get angry about that, and we would fight a lot. But partying and drinking was fun. I mean, it was a good time with my buds, you know. And I had a right to do that because I quit school and got a job, and I was doing what I needed to do, so you do what you need to do. And that's just what I thought and believed. And we ended up moving from New York to Virginia in the 80s. The big boom was happening in Northern Virginia. There was a lot of money to be had. I was working for like $2.15 an hour or something. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? Like $2.15 an hour. I'm getting old. And, you know, we heard, you know what? I left something very important out. When we got married, I hunted down my father. I wanted to meet my father, so I searched for him. He was an alcoholic, and I went to all the bars, and I left a note. This is Kyle, your son. I want to meet you. So one day the phone rang, and it was my father, and he showed up on my wedding day. So I met my father for the first time on my wedding day with my wife. And being the good alcoholic father that he was, he said, how long have y'all been together? I said, well, 3 years. He said, want to go out partying tonight? And I said, sure. So I left my bride at home on our wedding night and went out drinking with my father. And that created a lot of problems in the marriage early on. I didn't really know what to expect, so... So now I shared, you know, then my daughter's born. We moved to Virginia. And life, you know, I was told, you know, you can make $500 a week moving to Virginia, working roofing. And my father's idea. And I was like, we're going to be rich. Let's move to Virginia, man. We're going to live the life of this is great. This is big time, you know. So we moved here. And life was going pretty good. I mean, I was working hard. I was partying hard as a young man. But we had our own place, and it was nice, and I was making money. I'd bring cash home and throw it up in the air, and it'd fall all over the house, and the kids and my wife were all happy. And we thought it was going pretty good. And one day, I was working, and my father came pulling up to the job site, and he said, hurry up, get in, we got to go. There's been an accident. And I said, what's going on? And he said, Joey's been hit by a car. And I said, oh, okay. Well, my son Joey was a tough dude. I mean, he's 6 years old at this time, and he would jump off counters. And I mean, he was just absolutely crazy. And so I pictured him having a broken arm or something. And we were heading from Northern Virginia to the Winchester Hospital, which is where he was. And the phone on the dash of the truck was those big phones then. And it rang, and my father answered it, and I remember my father just let out a huge scream. And I knew what happened. At that very moment, I knew, but I didn't do anything. I just sat there. And for an hour, I didn't say a word. And my father was crying, and my brother was over here in the passenger seat crying, and I was in the middle of the truck, and I just sat there. And just stared ahead and didn't really feel anything, I don't think. So we got to the hospital and we came in and my wife ran up and embraced me and she said, "Joey's dead." And she said, "Joey's dead," and my family's crying, everybody's weeping and crying, and they asked me if I wanted to see him, and I said no. And I went into the bathroom, and I went into the stall, and I closed the door, and I locked it, and I sat down, and I took my cigarettes out, and I opened it, and I took a joint out that I had in there, and I lit it, and I smoked it. And that was the beginning of how I was going to deal with the death of my six-year-old son. I was 22 years old, and it just got worse and worse and worse. The anger and the rage inside of me became horrendous. I hated God. I hated the world. I hated everything and everybody because my son died. And I got two DUIs back to back within a month. I ended up going to jail. I was, you know, I was mean to the police. I'm like, just shoot me, man. Just kill me. I mean, I'm just crying out for something and didn't realize it. Blame the world. Poor me. Poor me. And I rode that for a long time. I used that. I should have had, realistically, probably 10 DUIs, but I got off of 6 of them because the police let me go because they felt sorry for me because I'd start crying and say that my son died and feel sorry for me. One night I got drunk and I came home within a year and I said to my wife, "Get naked. We're going to have a baby. I got to have a son. Somebody got to carry on this name." And she said, "What if we have a girl?" And I said, "Well, I don't care. We'll have 7 of them until we have a boy. We're going to have a baby. Get naked. We're going to, let's do this. Come on." So we did, and we were blessed immediately with a son. And I'll never forget the day that she came to the job and told me that she was pregnant and it's a boy, you know, sonogram time, and yeah, let me see it, you know. And I held her so hard, she said, "You're going to pop me." It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. So, but I still had this anger and this rage in me. And for 14 years, it continued. And it got worse and it got worse and it got worse. And I didn't realize what was growing inside of me. And I met a lot of people drinking and partying. We had bought a bar. You know, I thought, well, buy a bar. That's a good solution. I can get my alcohol for cost. But so we buy this dumpy bar, and, you know, it was a hole in the wall. That's where I like to drink. And, you know, I found myself hanging out with the worse I would get, the worse I'd look for people to hang out with because they made me look good. You know, see, I'm not like that guy. I'm not like that girl. I'm not like those people. And I wanted to think that I wasn't going where I was going. And during this period, I met a guy one time, and I was wallowing in my stuff and feel sorry for myself. And he looked at me and he said, "Face it, bud. This is hell. And when you die, you go to heaven." And I said, "Makes sense to me." And from that moment on, I believed that. I chose to believe that this was hell, and when you die, you go to heaven. And I made my life and everybody's life around me a living hell if they would allow me to. And I was totally spiritually dead, and I'd black out, come home and beat my wife. I'd bring women home to my house while my wife was in the bed, and I'd be like, "Hey, meet such and such." And I don't remember a lot of it, but it's who I became. So for 14 years, we lived this hate, abuse, blame, and rage. So that's what it used to be like. What happened was, after 20 years of marriage, I came home one day, and my wife had my bags packed, and she said, "I can't do it anymore." I had knocked her off that we have a island at our house with, I call them bar stools, but they're just stools. And I blacked out and knocked her out of one of that and hurt her back pretty bad. And she just had enough. And she had tried so hard to put up with me and tolerate this. And She truly loves me and loved me. And so she said, we're done. And I said, look at me. I've got 1,000 women want me. I'll go ahead to the bar and I'll just find me a woman tonight and screw you. And so I went to my bar and I walked in and sat at the bar, and there was a mirror, and I'm looking in the mirror and I'm looking around, and nobody wanted to hang out with me. Nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. And so I said, back with everybody, I'll just grab my big bag of cocaine and my booze and I'll go to my hotel room, and you know, a few days she'll settle down, things will get back to normal. She needs me. And when I was in my hotel room, that's what I mentioned earlier, I made phone calls. Nobody would come and see me. I mean, everybody got tired of just listening to me feel sorry for myself and my anger and my rage. Even the drunks didn't want nothing to do with me. So I'm laying in this hotel room, and, you know, I was always a guy who, when I met my father, he was a very ill man. And what I mean by that is he was a hurt person. And he would tell me, he wouldn't tell me you shouldn't do cocaine or you shouldn't drink. He would say, you need to make a lot of money so that when you want to get high, you can get high as you want to get. And so I was one of those who thought what you had defined who you were. And so I'd have the big bags of booze, you know, come on, see Kyle, man, I'm the big shot. Nobody would come. So I started realizing what was going on. And I thought about this, and I'm laying there in the bed looking up, and I thought about my wedding day. I thought about the day I seen her at the bathroom and asked me for the light. I thought about all the times the baby's being born and the hugging when she was pregnant for Kyle Jr., our second son, and all these happy times. And my kids had grown up through this misery. And my kids didn't like me anymore. You know, they loved me, but they didn't like me. They didn't want anything to do with me. Kyle told my wife one night, I hate Dad, and I never want to be like him. And I remember she told me that. And I started thinking about all these things, and I thought, how did it get like this? How did I go from there to here? How did I allow this to happen? And I started realizing what I was losing. And so I called my wife and I said, please, 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 please take me back. I'll change. I promise I'll change. She said, I can't. But, this is a good but. Not like you told your sponsor, but, you know, the good but. This is a good but. She said, but if you go to AA and you go to marriage counseling with me, I'll at least be open to trying to work things out. So on Tuesday, October 21st of 2003, I got to go to my first AA meeting and my first marriage counseling session in the same day. Boom, you know, explode, man. So I walk into this AA group. It's the Stepping Stones of Sterling, Virginia, and it's a men's group, and they call this the boot camp of AA. And I'm thankful that that's where I went for me because of my past. You go in there, and you know, you're a new guy, and anybody new, you know, yeah, Kyle, alcoholic, need help. And they go, new guy, who wants him? And all these guys raise their hand. I'll take them. Talk to me after the meeting. And then the guy leading the meeting goes, meet with Brad outside after the meeting. He's going to sponsor you. I'm like, what's this all about? So I sit there and I really don't remember what was said at that meeting. I remember the guy leading it because he looked funny. But I that's the only reason. I don't remember what was said at that meeting. I was too in my stuff. And I went outside with Brad after the meeting, and he said, listen, but you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? I said, yep. Want my wife back. He said, well, there's 5 basics we do here at the Stepping Stones. He said, first thing we need to do is you're going to call me every day. He said, what time are you going to call me? I said, I don't know. What time do you want me to call you? He said, how about 9 p.m.? He said, can you call me 9 p.m. tonight? I said, sure, I'll call you 9 p.m. tonight. He said, all right, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to work the steps, and you're going to read whatever I tell you to read and work whatever step I tell you to step, and I'm going to help you understand those steps. Did you see those steps on the wall in there? I said, yeah, I seen the steps on the wall. I wasn't, you know, definitely not doing 4 and 5. I mean, like everybody says, like looking at those things going, maybe, maybe, no, no, no. So, oh, I don't do God, by the way. He said to me, the next thing you're going to do is you're going to pray every day. And I said, no way, bud. That's where I'm going to draw the line. I don't pray. I don't do God. Listen, I hate him. He killed my son. And I mean, I got, you know, I'm like, and you need to know he killed my son. And he said, you don't have to pray to God. You just need to talk out loud. Every morning I want you to say, please keep me sober. And every night I want you to say, thank you for keeping me sober. If you're just talking to the air, could you do that? I said, yeah, I could do that as long as I'm talking to the air. And he said, we don't drink a day at a time. Can you go home tonight and not drink and come back tomorrow? I said, I'm pretty sure I can do that. And then he hit me with a big one. He said, and you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. You're going to go to a meeting every single day. You'd be here every day at 4:30. I said, wait a minute. I'm a busy guy. He said, you said you were willing to go to any lengths. He said, how about this? Can you come back tomorrow? I said, I'll come back tomorrow. And Brad began to teach me how to live life. I love him. I'm an emotional guy. A day at a time. And he helped me. And he talked to me every day. And I'd call him up and I didn't know how to talk. See, when I grew up, I don't know where I got it from, but I just believed that talking didn't do you any good. You know, just suck it up, man. Toughen up. And I wasn't a talker. Today you can't shut me up. But I was not a talker. And so I would just call him and say, it's me. And there'd be silence. Be like, you still there? Yeah. How was your day? I don't know, I'm pissed. I mean, you know, Chris is still a blankety blank. And I mean, you know, work blankety blank and all the stuff. And he'd just say, good, man, did you drink? I said, no. He said, well, then you had a good day. This guy's crazy. So one day at a time, we worked the steps. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I've learned a lot. And I don't want to jump too far ahead. But 2 months into sobriety, December 24th, 2003, we're at the mall, Christmas shopping. And I start feeling funny. And I'm like, what's wrong? I don't feel good. Well, I had a heart attack. 2 months sober, I go to the hospital. The doctor tells me that I'm lucky to be alive, that at 36 years old, most of the time, that young of a person, your heart should have exploded and you should be a dead man right now. He was like, you are so lucky you stopped doing all that cocaine, because I know you'd be a dead man if you were still drinking and doing that. So at this time, my sponsor had just put me on step 3. Now, step 2 did not, power greater was you guys. It was my group. It was my sponsor. There was no way I was doing God. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. And so he puts me on step 3, and then I have a heart attack. So I start thinking about some things, you know, and I'm reading step 3, and I'm like, the biggest part of that step to me was as we understood him. And I'm going, how am I going to understand this higher power? Who is he? And who's he going to be to me or it or whatever? I didn't know. And then I started asking myself this one question, scary to me to ask, but I said, what if that guy I met is wrong? And what if there really is a hell? And there really is a heaven, and this is earth, and when you die, you go to one or the other. Where would I go? And that scared me. So I decided to go out and seek and find this higher power of my understanding. And I started at AA talking to people. I would ask guys what you thought and who's your higher power? Tell me about him, you know. Tell me about it, whatever. I mean, I heard so many different things. And I decided to go to church. So we started, my wife and I started attending a church. And something that sticks out to me now. It didn't stick out to me then. But on page 45 in the big book, it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So then my sponsor pointed that out to me, and I said, what does that mean? And of course, with that early sobriety and the fog I had no idea. So we continued to work the steps and seek for a God of my understanding. I worked step four, and man, that was tough, putting everything down on paper and seeing what I'd become, who I'd become. It was painful. I was depressed. I walked around. Guys were like, what's wrong with you? I said, I'm on step four. Oh. We understand. We understand. Step five, you know, I meet with my sponsor, and, you know, I've been waiting for this, and anybody who's done it knows. I mean, I think you know, the anxiety, and oh my gosh, I mean, there's stuff on here, man. I don't even know if I could tell somebody. And then my sponsor's talking to somebody, and I'm like, stand there, and I'm like, Brad, we going to do this? And he looks at me and goes, I changed my mind. I think we're going to reschedule. And I'm like, cool. And he's just kidding. Just kidding. Great sense of humor, man. So we go do step five. And I left one thing off. And that's important for me to say because I am so thankful that I didn't pick up a drink. But I had something very, very embarrassing, sexual. And I wasn't going to share it. I held on to it, and every stinking meeting I went to was an honesty meeting after that for like a month. I mean it. And finally, one day, I seen Brad, you know, and I'm just like, I grabbed him, and I drug him outside like real fast. I'm like, I got to tell you something. And then he just looks at me, and he goes, that's it? And I'm like, that's it. And he goes, okay, man, see you tomorrow. Like, why didn't I tell him the other day, you know, a month and a half ago or whatever it was? So, course six and seven, you know, somebody had to tell me for seven, humbly asked him. I'm like, man, I'm working hard to get rid of this stuff. You know, I mean, I'm doing everything I can. I still find, you know, I'm still an ass. And, you know, he's like, well, Kyle, it's not you. You notice it says him. You need to ask him to do it, not you do it. Ah, I get it. And you're learning. Step eight, I was excited about the list. By this point in my life, I really, really, really wanted to do amends. I wanted to restore relationships. I was really looking forward to them. Except for my father, I wouldn't put him on the list. We had a falling out, and it just wasn't good. And so my sponsor said, well, don't put him on the list right now. You know, it says became willing, right? You're not willing, so don't put him on the list. I was like, oh, it's that easy, huh? He said, yeah. So I like to complicate things. I'm glad he didn't. So nine, amazing. I mean, my mother, I had done so much damage, and our relationship was restored. My son, Kyle Jr., my daughter, Marie, my wife, Chris, amazing restoration through step nine for me. We all know 10... some of us more than others, you know, when I mess up, got to take care of it. 11, very important step for me. I pray today, and God speaks to me. So we were heading to church one day through, you know, this is, I'm coming up on 4 years. And we're heading to church one day, and there'd been a hurricane. And on the way to our church, there's a median down the middle of the road, and there's Bradford pear trees in there. And a bunch of those trees were falling in the road, and some of them were leaning, and some were still standing, and it was just a disaster area for that area from the storm came through. And I don't know what I'm thinking. I'm driving, my wife's sitting over here, and I look at my wife, I say, "What kind of tree you think I am?" And she says, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, the Bible refers to men like trees. You will be like a tree planted by the water, strong, tall, and solid. What kind of tree do you think I am?" She said, "Nothing." She didn't answer me. I have no idea at that time why that came through my mind or why I would ask that question. So we just kind of moved on. We went to church and that was it. Well, I celebrated 4 years and I came home. Life is fantastic. My relationships are restored. My son, Kyle Jr., loves me. We're building a relationship. My daughter loves me. My wife, I mean, life is good for me. I'm thanking God every single day. And I go downstairs, I knock on Kyle Jr.'s door, and he opens his door, and he's a teenager, you know, 17. And I'm like, "Look, son." And I show him my chip, and he takes it and looks at it and says, "Man, Dad, I'm proud of you." And he gives me a big hug. And then he went back in his room, shut the door in my face. You believe that? I was like, "What's up with that?" But it was very, very special. So a few nights later, my wife and I are sitting on the couch watching a Lifetime movie. It's very important, Lifetime. When you get sober, you're secure enough with yourself, you can watch Lifetime. So we're sitting home watching a Lifetime movie, and my son Kyle was with his girlfriend, and he calls me and he says, "Hey, Dad, will you come pick me up? I need a ride." And I said, "Man, I'm watching a movie. Why don't you call Will?" Will was Kyle Jr.'s best friend. And Will was 20 years old. Kyle was 17. And they were good friends. And Kyle said, "All right." And he hung up and he called me back a couple minutes later. He said, "All right, Dad, everything's good. Will's going to come and get me." We went to bed and I said to Chris, I said, "Kyle should have been home by now." And then we had a knock on the door. And the officer said there'd been a bad accident. And he said that Will was dead and that Kyle was being flown to Fairfax Hospital and it was very, very, very bad. At that moment, I crumbled to the floor and I thought I was going to puke. And I was laying there on the floor, and my wife's like standing over me going, "Get up, we got to go." And so I got up, and I, you know, you're taught, I called my sponsor every day. And I automatically, you know, I would ask all these questions like, why do I got to do these things? Sometimes they don't make sense, but they make sense. I immediately called my sponsor. I had a mentor in my life at this time too, a spiritual mentor, and I immediately called him. They met us at the hospital and we walked in and they took us to a little room and they said, "Kyle's going to die." And we wanted to believe that he was going to live and we prayed. And we know a very powerful God who can do anything he wants to do. And we said that and we told everybody that. And people came in, pastors and AA people, and I mean, man, and we prayed and we begged, and the next day Kyle died. And I remember when we prayed one prayer, it was just me and my wife and my pastor and my sponsor, and we prayed a prayer, and I remember saying, "God, no matter what you decide, we're going to honor you. We're going to trust you, and I'm going to keep on going." So we did. We said goodbye to Kyle and celebrated his life. And it was very, very difficult, a lot of hard times. But we had people to talk to. And you remember the old Verizon commercial where the guy would be standing, he'd turn around, and he'd have those like a million people behind him? That's what my wife and I felt like we had. I use that analogy. I mean, I was like, that's what we feel like. I mean, you guys are so amazing. You know, everybody just comes together and surrounds you with love. And everything that you need. So we had that. And I went to a lot of meetings, and I shared, and we kept going. I personally listened to Christian radio, and I was listening to the radio about 6 months after Kyle died, and there was a miracle, and they were talking about it on the radio. A 17-year-old boy had gotten into a severe car accident, just like my son. He was diagnosed with severe brain trauma, just like my son, and they said he was going to die, just like my son. And they brought their pastors in and their church and their people, just like my son. And they prayed for him. And the next day he sat up and said, "What happened?" And it was a miracle. At that moment, the anger that flowed through me was unbelievable. I was so angry that I had to pull my truck over. And by this time, I had gotten to this place. I heard a story one time that really touched my heart, and it was about a riverboat pilot. And what happens is when the big ships come in from the ocean and through the bay, and they're going to enter the river's canal, there's a riverboat pilot that is sent to meet the ship in the bay. And that riverboat pilot apparently stands kind of like behind and beside the captain of the ship, and he tells him what way to go, because he knows that river channel like it's, you know, it's the palm of his hand. And he'll tell that captain, he'll say, "I suggest you turn 7 degrees port," or, "I suggest you turn 12 degrees starboard." But here's the thing, if that ship runs aground, it's the captain of the ship that's responsible, not the riverboat pilot. And so when I heard that story, I thought about that as the riverboat pilot's my higher power. And so I started asking, talking to my higher power and listening to his direction. And when this happened, I said, "Okay, God, who do you want me to call?" And immediately a name popped into my mind and I called him. And this guy listened to the story that I just told you all. And after I was done, he paused for a moment, and this is what he said to me. He said, "Kyle, I have no idea. I can't tell you why Kyle died and why this boy lived. But what I can tell you is that God trusts you. Maybe that other family wasn't strong enough to stay together and get through this. Maybe there's something in their life and they were holding on too tight, and God knew. But most of us go through our life wondering if we can trust God. And I want to tell you that God trusts you. He trusts you to do the right thing. He trusts you not to pick up a drink. He trusts you to do the right thing with this anger right here, right now." And that was huge to me at that point in my life. And I think it took a lot of guts to tell somebody that too. I mean, only a solid person could say that, because it could have been a mistake at the same time. So I started, it changed everything. Because now it became, instead of about me and my, you know, it became, wow, God trusts me. This is amazing. I mean, he might have picked the wrong guy. I don't know. So, you know, after the death of two sons, I do have to say that my wife and I were still working things out, but things got rough. We were going to church. I was getting sober, but it seemed like we were getting farther and farther apart. And we started arguing a little bit more, and things were going on inside, and I couldn't figure them out. I would literally lay my hands on my wife while she was sleeping. I would say, "God, I love this woman. Please show me what I need to do to save this marriage and save her and help me to be the husband she needs." And through those prayers, God sent me to meet some people who prayed with me and asked God to show me what was really going on. And so God showed me what was going on. And my wife ended up going to see some people and praying with them to see what was going on with her, and God showed her what was going on. So one night I come home and I say, "Baby, I got to talk to you." And I sat her down, and immediately tears started streaming out of my down my face, and I said, "I need to ask your forgiveness." And I said, "I've asked God to forgive me, but I have been blaming you for over 20 years for the death of Joey, because you weren't at the bus stop. And if you would have been there, I think he'd still be alive today." And that unforgiveness and that resentment is destroying me and destroying us. And my wife looked at me and said, "I need to ask your forgiveness, because I've been blaming you for Kyle's death. If you would have got up off the couch, he may still be alive today." We held each other for I don't know how long, just weeping. And I say that I believe that moment God reached down and removed the cancer from our marriage. And he healed us. And we have been, it's been amazing since. It's been amazing. There's a lot of other things that God has done that he shows me when I pray today. What it's like now, I could go on and on and on about, but there's a couple stories that I want to tell. One is about a young man named Jake. Through the sobriety and this healing that God has done in my life and in my family's life, and we were talking about it earlier, and it's amazing. And through this, I went to a young man's group for healing. Like after Kyle died, I knew I needed something. I said, "Well, maybe working with some kids, with some teens will help me, you know, young boys." So I went and worked with him, and this one boy just stood out, you know. One boy, it's like a flashing neon light, you know. And I just really felt God say, "I want you to get to know him." So I walk up, and I'm like, "Hey, I'm Kyle," you know, trying to be cool, you know, kid's a teen. He said, "I'm Jake," and I got to know Jake. And one day, I called Jake on his cell phone, and I'm like, "Hey, Jake, it's Kyle." And he goes, "Hey, Mr. Kyle." And then I start talking, and I hear him go, "Shut up, man, stop it, it's my mentor." And I'm like, whoa. So I get to know Jake. We start hanging out together. I take him fishing. He helped me a lot with healing because my son and I fish together a lot, and I gave up fishing for a while after Kyle died. It was painful, but I got back out there. So Jake had a rough life too, and he's struggling with God and believing. And one day he comes to me and goes, "You know what, Mr. Kyle, I think, if God loves me like everybody says, and if all this stuff is real, then why is my life so bad? We just found out my grandma's going to die. My mom's been sick forever. I mean, we have no money. I feel like we're poor in Northern Virginia. Everybody's got things." You know, he really was just seeing pain in his life. And I sat there that day and I listened to him and I said, "I don't know what to say right now, Jake, but I'm going to pray and I'm going to talk to you when you get back from visiting with your father." And so I did, and I got a message for Jake, and it ended up, in my opinion, being a very powerful message. I gathered up a whole bunch of pictures of my family, of Joey, of my daughter, of my family, and I got together with Jake, and I sat him down, and I said, "Hey, man, I've been praying about what you asked, and I want to talk to you." And I just started showing him these pictures. I said, "This was Joey looking, and it, you know, it's all good, and remembering Joey in the good times. This is Marie, and this is my wife and I. This was when we were at Disney." And the last picture that I had was the picture of Kyle Jr. the day he died on the hospital bed. And I reached over to hand it to Jake, and he wouldn't grab it like he did all the other pictures. His eyes welled up, and they got glassy. And I said, "And this is Kyle, the day he died." And I said, "Jake," I said, "are you happy that we know each other? Are you happy that we met? Do you feel good that we got to hang out together and we're fishing together and we're spending time together? I mean, do you feel that we've benefited each other in our lives?" And he said, yes, I do, Mr. Kyle. And I said, I need to tell you that chances are if Kyle wouldn't have died, I'd have never met you. I'd have never got to hang out with you, and we wouldn't have what we have. So I'm going to tell you, I don't know why, and I don't understand, but what I do know is if you continue to trust God, that He will show you. And the other story that I want to share is my son, Kyle Jr., before he passed away, one night I get phone calls from him all the time. And I got a phone call that he had wrecked his four-wheeler and broke his leg on the road. He was riding on the road. We live in the country, thankfully. And when I showed up there, of course, I got in my truck, speed over there, you know, worried about him. And his leg was bent in ways that it shouldn't be bent. I knew it was serious, so I dialed 911. And once again, I heard my sponsor go, hello? I'm like, man. No wonder you do this stuff, you know. So it was bad. He broke his femur. And apparently when you break your femur, major vessels in your leg, and, you know, your bone kind of overlaps. And so they bring in a helicopter. We got a really cool helicopter ride that night. And costs a lot of money, too. And we went to the hospital, and I rode with him. She drove in the car. And, you know, I'll never forget Kyle Jr. was laying there on that hospital bed. And this doctor walks in with these weights like you put on barbells. And he's got a rope tied to him, and he sets the weights on the floor, and he gets to the head of the foot of that bed, and he looks at my son, and he goes, this is going to hurt, young man. And he grabbed Kyle's leg, and he pulled on it, and he had to reset that bone. And Kyle let out a scream that I'll never forget. And, you know, at that, this is the amazing thing. At that moment, at that time, I would have done anything to not hear that scream. Today, I would do anything to hear it. Then, after he set the bone, he took those weights and he tied them to Kyle's ankle and he left them hanging over the end of the bed. And my son was furious. I mean, he was like mad, like now it's his time to hate, you know. And medicine today is very cool. They were going to put a rod in his leg. And so they said, we're going to put a rod in his leg today. And tomorrow morning he's going to be up and walking. He's going to start putting a little pressure on his toe. And you're going to get him up. And we're like, okay, you know, wow. I mean, are you sure? Yeah, okay. You're the doctor. And they did the surgery. And the next day, I'll never forget us making Kyle get up. He was so angry. And in so much pain. And when we made him stand up and he had to put that toe on the floor, and you know, it's like you've got to push a little, Kyle. Oh, I mean, I hate you. I don't want to do this. And it was so painful for him. And we'd let him sit back down. And then when it was time, we would do it again. And 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 fast forward. Eventually, Kyle was doing wheelies on his four-wheeler again, trying to break the other one, you know. What does that have to do with my sobriety? I started really thinking about sobriety and those steps. And that's exactly what those steps did for me. It was just without a broken bone. It was my broken heart. It was my broken insides. And through the power of those steps and working with a sponsor who knew what he was doing, and with sharing and learning how to express myself, my brokenness became healed. And today, I run and I play and I really, really, really am blessed and enjoy my life. The other thing that has to do with that is one day I was praying and I don't know what happened really, but I was in an emergency room and I was 10 years old and I remember it, and I went back here in my mind, and this nurse came in, and I had cut myself, and the nurse came in and looks at it, and she pours this nasty green stuff on her something, and she took this gauze, and I remember her starting to rub it, and she said, this is going to hurt, and she's scrubbing this wound, and she was talking to me as she was cleaning this wound, and she said, I've got to do this. Because if I don't get the infection, the dirt out of this wound, it will become infected. And if it becomes infected, it's going to be worse, and it will be much more painful than it is for me to do this for you. And she was trying to talk to me to keep my mind off it as she was doing it. And then all of a sudden I was back in this, in my room, you know, where I was praying. And I clearly heard my higher power say to me, Kyle, you still have many wounds that need to be cleaned. And it's going to hurt. But we need to clean them because they've become infected. And I'm going to make you whole. I'm going to make you everything that I created you to be. And I stand here today looking forward to that a day at a time without picking up a drink, working the steps, going to meetings. Today I'm blessed to stand up here and be able to share this with you. And I just pray and hope that something I said helps, that something in my story resonates with someone. And I am going to keep coming back because I love this. I love this place. I love you. I don't know many of you here, but I love you. I mean, it's AA. You know, we were talking about it. You can go anywhere and you're welcomed and you're the same and you're not judged. And you come in and we understand each other. And though everybody might not agree with my concept of a higher power, it's fine. That's the blessing of AA. That's the greatness of AA, is that we come in here and we get sober. The 12 and 12 says, happy and purposeful lives in the foreword. And today, I have a happy and purposeful life. Thank you very much for allowing me to share. I'm going to keep coming back.